oral history program. Oral history number 54. Thursday, April 22nd, 1982. I'm Paul Anderson, archivist at the Washington University Medical Library. This interview is part of our series of interviews with medical school alumni. I'm speaking today with Dr. Harry Egress, class of 1932. Dr. Egress was born in St. Louis, December 27, 1908. He graduated from Washington University, as I said, in 1932, and began practicing that same year in Missouri. For 3 years, he was in residence at Jewish Hospital in St. Louis, at further graduate study at the University of Minnesota from 1935 to 1936. 1936, he entered private practice. His private practice was interrupted during World War II. We'll get into that. He was served with General Hospital 21. In 1957, he started the Midwestern Cytology Laboratory, Incorporated, which is still operating. And he was a member of the clinical faculty in internal medicine at Washington University School of Medicine, and has had emeritus status with that faculty since 1960. He has also been a consultant with the Department of Pathology at Veterans Hospital, 1948 to 1960. He is a member of professional societies, including the American Society of Cytology, American Medical Association, Missouri Medical Society, and the St. Louis Medical Society. Well, now to begin. Dr. Egress, I saw you signal a correction in that curriculum vitae that perhaps I've made too. I said that you entered practice right after your graduating. How was I wrong there?
I went into my residency program and then went into practice in 36.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I realized as soon as I said that I had made an error. Well, let's go back to the years before you even began to study medicine. Were there any factors in your family background and childhood which influenced you to study medicine?
Yes, actually, I was interested in becoming a concert violinist, but at age 13, my teacher told me that I might be able to play in a symphony orchestra, but not be concert magnitude. And our private family physician, Dr. David Todd, who practiced here in St. Louis, influenced me greatly in wanting to go into the practice of medicine.
Mm-hmm. Were there any family that were in the medical profession at
No.
all?
No. My family background was that of merchants.
Uh-huh. What secondary school did you attend here in St. Louis?
Central High School of St. Louis.
Uh-huh. Can you recall in what major ways medicine was practiced that was very different from the medicine of now when you were a young man?
Yes. Medicine in my early days was mostly, quotes, the art of medicine without all of the sophisticated technologic advances that have occurred since. And most of those have occurred since World War II and perhaps as a result of World War II.
Mm-hmm. There wasn't anything, though, that involving your own health or any experience that you had that had a...
No, I had no personal health problem, or a family health problem that suggested the idea of practicing medicine.
Why did you choose to attend the Washington University School of Medicine?
Actually, I had scholarships at Harvard in the pre-med courses in a legal area because I had done a lot of debating But my family didn't want me to leave St. Louis, and their friends told them there just wasn't any medical school other than Washington University.
I see. Well, I noticed from the list that of your graduating class that the same time you were awarded your MD degree, you also were awarded the Bachelor of Science in Medical Science. Now, you didn't mention a bachelor's degree in your curriculum vitae. How did it happen that, what was your pre-medical training in college?
Well, this was not achieved through the pre-med course. I achieved this BS degree while I was a medical student, having spent the whole summer on a public health survey of the water supplies of the environs of St. Louis. And I think that this is a rather unique sort of combination. I doubt that anybody has ever had a BS in medical science from this university, and I doubt that anyone has a combination of BS in medical science and an MD.
I see. This wasn't, though, the equivalent of your bachelor's degree. You had a...
I had 3 years of pre-med before I came here.
Uh-huh. Where did you study there?
Washington University.
Washington University again.
Mm-hmm.
I see. So then, did the fact that you took this Bachelor of Science in Medical Science mean that you studied longer?
I had to put in a lot of extra hours.
Uh-huh.
Put in a whole summer and then part of that fall to acquire the credits for this recognition.
Well, all right. You entered medical school. Can you tell me something about the costs of being a medical student in those days? First of all, you would have entered in 1929, is that
28.
28, okay.
And it was around $600 a year tuition.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. How did you, what was the source of your tuition? Did you have to earn it, or did your family...
Well, it was a combination of all things. You recall at that time we were heading into the Great Recession. My last 2 years of tuition were paid by my grammar school teacher, who was a friend of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked after hours selling shoes, worked on playgrounds during the summer, the St. Louis playground, St. Louis school playground system.
Well, the Depression hadn't begun. Everybody thought things were rosy in 1928, and then it hit while you were in medical school. Did you ever think that you might not have had this opportunity had the Depression already begun when you...
That's a possibility.
Did you live at home?
Yes.
When you were a medical student? Were most of the medical students in your class from the St. Louis area? Recall?
Not most. I don't recall the numbers, but I wouldn't say that most of them were. No, there was a wide scattering over the whole country, actually, of medical students. And we had at that time what we call the Eastern Invasion. It was one of the first classes where we had quite a large representation of men from the New York area.
Uh-huh. Do you think there was a conscious policy to recruit out of state at that time?
I was given to understand that was part of the policy of the university in order to give us two things. First of all, widespread representation in our classes and widespread representation when these men left the St. Louis area.
I see. There are a few students in your class who might be interpreted to have foreign names. Perhaps they were Americans just like the majority, but I see some conspicuously Oriental names. Were there foreign students?
Yes, I recall Inouye, who is from Hawaii. He's Japanese origin.
Uh-huh. He has the same name as the senator who represents.
Right.
I wonder if they're related. Do you know if anybody came from outside the United States? I realize Hawaii was a American territory, but there were any foreign... bona fide foreign students?
Offhand, I don't recall any.
Mm-hmm. How about women in the class? Let's see, there was a
A woman.
Faye Solomon, perhaps?
No.
No? I'm misreading my
name. Can you stop your machine? I'll look at that list.
All right. Well, for the record, the sole woman in the class of 1932 was Lillian Hadsel.
Right.
She went on to take a residency at New York Infirmary for women and children. How about blacks or members of other...
There were no blacks.
No blacks in the class. What do you recall about the preclinical facilities, the actual physical setup when you began as a medical student? Were they, first of all, adequate to the needs of...
In general, there was crowding, and the rooms were old, unreconstructed, nothing like all the changes that have taken place in recent years with the facilities today.
Can you recall any situations that were, obviously there are just countless things that are different now, but things that were strike you as radically different? How about, for example, in anatomy and dissection? Did they?
That was an interesting situation. In the first place, the facilities were crowded, but the most interesting part of that was that they decided the year of our class to open the anatomy dissecting rooms to night work, which practically put everybody on notice that you better get up there at night and do the dissecting clean. And that had a little spill off that was fun. There was a very good saloon, you'll recall this was still Prohibition, there was a very good saloon on Clayton and Taylor, and around about 9:30 at night we'd march ourselves down to this bar where we'd have a few beers and head back to the anatomy room, and then a few interesting episodes occurred along with that, such as one classmate threatening another to dissect him.
Gracious, I mean, threatening with one of the...
scalpels.
The scalpels, my God. Must have been rather strong stuff that they were putting out of that saloon.
Yes,
is it the same? Is it the same building where there is a bar now?
I haven't checked that out in recent years.
There's a bar called Kevin McGee's down the street at that very corner.
It has to be probably the
very same place. And that was an illegal saloon.
Yes.
What was it masquerading as? A coffee shop? Is that?
No, I just called it a saloon.
And they just nobody raided it. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very interesting. How about the sciences that we're using, for example, physiology and that we're using new kinds of equipment. What do you recall about that kind of course?
Physiology really didn't have much in the way of new equipment that I can recall. The thing I remember most is smoke drums that didn't always work in these physiology experiments. Most interesting thing about physiology really was Dr. Erlanger, who became a Nobel Prize winner and was a marvelous teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And the other interesting thing about physiology is that they had a motor-driven screen for projection. That seemed to be the great thing of the course.
Would this be projecting the experiments on nerve?
It would be projecting
impulses.
Physiology, literature, and so forth during a lecture.
Oh, I see. Oh, the actual
but the
text.
Screen was being motor-driven. That seemed to be a great thing in that department.
I see. Uh-huh. Well, you did mention Erlanger. Do you have any particular reminiscences about him and his teaching methods?
Yes, he was very gentle, and he... But he was thorough and without being dry, and this was an interesting combination because we had many people instructing us who were quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Who might you contrast him with? Who was?
Well, let's take Dr. Ernest Sachs, who was professor of surgery. He was a wild man.
Mm-hmm.
Who would get us down into the thing we call the pit, the snake pit for our surgical lectures, and he would drop his glasses off to the end of his nose, put one hand on your right shoulder, and take some fullback from Kansas and back him all the way to the wall. And by the time he had him well in tow, the student didn't know what he was talking about.
Oh, and it was this, did this have any practical pedagogical purpose?
His forcefulness, I think, helped impress you with certain features of his area. He was a wild man in the operating room, too. He'd throw instruments and slap hands and so forth. And I worked out a technique for stopping him. I also knew that after he got through with his tantrums, he was very apologetic and very gentle. And so I kept my white shoes polished to a fairly well until I got into the pit, and then I stuck my foot in front of him. He stepped on my shoe, so he got it dirty and apologized the rest of the time. Never did ask me a question.
Do you think he was threatening his own aseptic environment with all this wild behavior?
No, I think that I don't know quite what the faculty is like now, but what I've seen of them, they are not quite the cast of characters that we had back then, and I'll mention others to you as we go along. But this is one of the men who stood out in the minds of every student who went through this Washington University.
Was Everett's Graham? Everett's Graham was already here.
Yes, I have an interesting story about him. He was very staid. When he lectured, he was forceful, like all surgeons are. He cut everything to the bone. But it was, again, the same strong delivery of Ernest Sachs without his antics. He and I became very friendly because he and his wife sat behind us at the symphony orchestra's concerts for many years, and so I would stop in and visit him very frequently as I came through the hospital. One day I walked in and he said, "Get rid of that cigarette." And I sort of looked at him and wondered what he was talking about, because I know he was a smoker. And so I got rid of it. A few weeks later I came through again with a cigarette hanging out of my mouth and got the same reception. And I said, "Excuse me, but what's going on here? You're a smoker." And he said, "Tomorrow you'll hear." And the next day they published the first report on the linkage of cancer and of the lung and smoking.
We have some famous photographs of him working with a smoking machine, you know, that to trap the tars and nicotine residue. Is that the experimentation that led to these?
That was subsequent.
I see.
The original work was primarily statistical, done by one of his associates. And incidentally, I was there at the first pneumonectomy he did for carcinoma of the lung.
Oh, really?
On a physician. And it's interesting that Dr. Graham died a few years later of carcinoma of the lung. This physician lived to be 80.
Yes, that is an ironic situation. How does it happen that you were present there? Was it a...
We knew that it was coming off, and I was still in the area, you see.
So the attending staff of the area could come in like it was...
Yes, there was a... Operating rooms had amphitheaters with seats up in the balcony overlooking the operating stage.
Going back now to when you were still a student, I noticed you made a list of some of the other people that you particularly remember. Can you give me some of their names?
Yes, this list is rather long because I think we had a fantastically interesting cast of characters teaching us at the medical school. Perhaps the first contact is with the dean of the medical school, who was Dr. McKim Marriott. Very shiny, bald head. He was a dean of the medical school, and we were assembled in this little auditorium at the entrance near the library, and he marched down the aisle and said, "Good morning, gentlemen. In 2 months, 10% of you won't be here. Get to work," and that's all I have to say. That was our introduction to medical school. A lot of us were ready to walk out right then and there. There were many others, and if you like, I'd like to mention some of them.
Sure, please.
There was a Dr. Ronzoni, a female physician.
Ethel Ronzoni?
Ethel Ronzoni, whose husband was in the physiology department. Mm-hmm. She was in pharmacology.
This was George Bishop.
George Bishop, right. Mm-hmm. And she affected a very mannish attitude, always wore slacks back when slacks were hardly known among women, and constantly smoked a cigarette and had a whiskey voice and a very pleasant personality that was helpful.
Were you in her lab at any time?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was a student in her laboratory. We had a classmate named Cecil Charles who had an odd position. He had his PhD in anatomy almost, but not quite, and he couldn't get it because he was lacking one credit from the University of Kentucky, where they would not teach evolution. So while he was an assistant in the anatomy lab for our class, he was taking second year comparative anatomy classes out on the hill at Washington University in the undergraduate school to get the credit to meet this PhD.
Now, where would the PhD be granted from? From Kentucky?
He was going to get it here in anatomy.
I see.
But he had gotten his undergraduate work in Kentucky with the exception of this one requirement.
It was still the old Scopes trial legislation.
Isn't that a curious thing? Uh-huh. He was PhD candidate, classmate, and still had to take a course there. In the GU department, we had a man named John Cook. They called him Johnny Cook. Very debonair, wore a flower in his lapel, and had all sorts of interesting but trite sayings. Like when he did his cystoscopies, he used ultraviolet for the treatment of some tumors, and his favorite saying was, we'll put sunshine in his bladder and sunshine in his smile. Mm. And he lived up to that sort of thing. Then we had a man named Albert Taussig, who was an internist of the old school and a fabulous teacher and a very forgetful man. He take the wrong car off the parking lot and that sort of thing, but he knew his medicine very well. Dr. Willard Bartlett Sr., who put on a sideshow like nothing you've ever seen. He was in thyroid surgery by the time we were there, and he was working primarily at Missouri Baptist Hospital, and we'd go over there to watch him do thyroidectomies. Now, when you went there, you felt like you were in a movie set. First of all, he only had beautiful girls as his assistants. He had a woman as his assistant who opened everything up and got it all ready for Dr. Bartlett. Dr. Bartlett would come in with a great fanfare, and beautiful women would put his gowns on and help him with his gloves, and you just never seen a sideshow like this. Hugo Ehrenfest, who was in the department of OBGYN, who was a masterful drawer, and he would draw pictures of anatomy on the blackboard using both hands.
Uh-huh.
They always came out in the right place.
Uh-huh.
But he had more than just drawing pictures going far.
This must have been superbly coordinated when he was practicing, too.
Right.
Then.
Arthur Pretz, who became a famous ear, nose, and throat man, very debonair.
Mm-hmm.
You could just feel the suave sort of personality going through you. Albert Key, who was just the opposite. He was a roughneck orthopedic man who said what he thought and thought what he said, and was a real character. There was an ear, nose, and throat man named Alden. You could follow him through the hospital by the odor behind him. He only smoked Turkish cigarettes.
I wouldn't necessarily want to be his patient if he was that.
Well, those were the days before we got into prohibiting smoking.
I see. It was just regarded as every man's right.
His debonair look went along with this perfumed odor. Dr. Jerome Cook, who was a very fine internist, whom I continued to see over at Jewish Hospital, who acted the Sphinx, practically never said anything, but when he did, it was pretty worthwhile. Arthur Strauss, who was a very, very meticulous cardiologist and an excellent teacher in cardiology. Roland Clemmy, who was a wild man, just like Dr. Sachs in neurosurgery, but not quite as wild. And he cut quite a swath throughout the community as a... There's an internist named Louis Cohn who graduated from here. I think he was the first to introduce this very small bag for physicians rather than a standard doctor's black bag. The dop kit size.
Oh, you mean this was a smaller version of the old?
Yes.
Doctor.
And
he wasn't carrying around so many medicines.
And he was dop kit size himself.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe he felt better about himself if he was carrying a smaller bag. How about Dr. Terry in anatomy?
Oh, yes, I'm going to get to him. I have him up here.
Okay.
He was interesting in one particular respect, and that was that he generally lectured in a rather dry style, but along with it he threw in humorous little things that he mentioned in his lectures. One of them was about a very famous anatomist who said to his class, as he was holding up a specimen of a penis, "This is the finest penis I've ever held in my hand," but he had a habit of keeping one hand in his pocket, and one of the students piped up with, "Which hand, doctor?"
How about Mildred Trotter? Was she
She was our anatomy instructor.
Uh-huh.
And she's still around.
Yes.
We all revere her very much.
Was she effective instructor
yes,
then?
Yes, very effective. And she was young and she was beautiful.
Uh-huh.
And I think she's still pretty good looking.
Uh-huh. What, in view of your work later in cytology, the word is associated in my mind with Dr. Cowdery, and who had joined the staff not too... or just about the same time as you began studying medicine.
We were the first class he had here in histology. He was helpful to me personally. We became personally good friends after I graduated, and I had decided I'd like to go into hematology. Now, in those days, fellowships weren't around like they are now. You sought them out, and I knew the work of Dr. Hal Downey at the University of Minnesota. So I wrote Dr. Hal Downey and told him I would like to come there and sit in at his feet. And he is a very gruff sort of guy when you first meet him. And he said, "Nothing doing, I don't have any time for you." So I went over to Dr. Cowdery with Dr. Gray, my mentor in pathology at Jewish Hospital. And Dr. Cowdery said, "Of course you've got to go." And he just put in a long distance telephone call to Dr. Downey, and that got me placed there.
So Cowdery was personally a very sympathetic individual.
Yes.
Well, you mentioned not having a lot of grants. We have Dr. Cowdery's papers, and I gather from that that he was one of the first individuals who really knew how to swing big money and big financial grants and other support. Is that?
Yes. He was one of the early movers in that direction. And he was very politically minded.
Uh-huh.
He didn't look like a politician, but he somehow or other got into it. I got my money from a patient, a grateful patient at Jewish Hospital, who gave me $1,000 to go away.
Uh-huh. So that's when you went to
University of Minnesota.
Uh-huh. Just to continue again with a little bit further with Cowdery, when he came and set up a division of cytology within the anatomy department, were there any kind of hard feelings of the older, like Dr. Terry was shunted aside to any degree, or was there any anything that you
mentioned? I don't think we students were into that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. If there was, I wasn't aware of it.
Because officially he was a division head under Terry, and yet he always referred to himself as a department chairman. And I was often wondered whether that represented any sort of dispute that between an older kind of anatomy and a new kind of
I never got any inkling
experimental
of that
line of thought. Of course, now anatomy has really drifted far from the old gross.
That's right.
Investigations. They still teach gross anatomy, but it's primarily oriented at this medical school toward neuroanatomy and as their research specialty. And of course, that all bespeaks the kind of microscopic analysis and investigations that began about this time.
Well, back then, one of the first ultramicroscopes was built in that department.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of hubbub about that, what this machine was all about.
This is the early
electron microscope.
Microscope?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so I can see you've had quite an interesting period as time as a medical student. Of course, the university prided itself then as now as a research center. Did you have any opportunity to do research when you were a medical student?
Well, nearest thing to it was that health survey, which I consider a form of research problem.
Well, this perhaps be the time for you to elaborate on that experience. How did you happen to get this opportunity?
Well, it came through the bacteriology department, Dr. Bronfenbrenner. I asked him if there wasn't something I could do, and he suggested this possibility. He said, "We can't give you any help, you're on your own." So I simply set out with a set of boots, and I went through sewers and waterworks and whatnot.
Well, why did the situation come up? Had there been a crisis in public health, epidemic or something like this that set it off?
It was the unique situation of St. Louis as an independent city and the county separated from it politically, mm-hmm. which still exists.
Mm-hmm.
And this created a number of problems in particularly water supply in the early days. Some of the county communities were buying water from St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just this problem of whether there was a possibility of bringing them together
mm-hmm.
or why they were separated that made the study interesting.
Well, some of the water lines in that day, and maybe even to this day, were very, very old. Did you encounter problems that resulted from St. Louis being an old municipality?
Even back then, they considered St. Louis as one of the best water supplies in the world from a treatment standpoint. And there were no special problems except in isolated areas where water was not obtained from the St. Louis supply.
I see. So
private wells and that sort of thing where typhoid existed back then. So we saw some typhoid. But these were primarily private water supplies on a piece of property rather than public water supply.
Just talking about the subject of urban public health, let's digress a moment. There were major kind of urban public health problems that have changed quite radically, like, for example, air pollution, smoke abatement, smoke pollution was a big problem in the 30s, was it not? I've seen pictures, horrible pictures of the sky just black with
absolutely cold black. And this was a major problem here was the coal supply, soft coal coming from Illinois. And once the ex-mayor of St. Louis, whose name I can't recall at the moment, who was an engineer, suggested banking techniques in firing furnaces and the treatment of the coal prior to firing a furnace that eliminated this almost overnight. It was like drawing a curtain off the city. But there were times when it was absolutely, you couldn't see a foot in front of your nose.
Dr. Park White, who was a clinical pediatrician, did some public health surveys. Do you know anything about them?
I don't know about those, no.
I think he was investigating, lead poisoning in some of the inner city homes.
Well,
it doesn't ring any...
That's a problem that still exists, because a lot of these homes were painted with lead paint, and as the paint came loose, children would eat the chips, and these chips were loaded with lead.
What do you recall, go on to a different topic altogether, what do you recall about the medical library?
Well, of course, the medical library happened to be a very favorite place of mine, because I rarely bought a book, even rarely bought a textbook. I liked studying subjects independently and in depth, and I used the library to a great extent. I fell asleep in it many a night.
When you moved across the street to the clinical training, recall anything about the facilities or situations that you, we've already touched upon them to some degree, and talking about hospital amphitheaters and the like, but anything you can recall about
compared to the present auditoriums that we have today, these little pits, as I call them, were very small, crowded, antiquated.
What about Barnes Hospital? It was primarily where most of the patients were on wards, were they not?
A good number of patients on wards, and these wards were huge, practically open things with jaw curtains to separate a bed. I'd say many of the wards had as many as 30 or 40 patients in them.
St. Louis in those days was a legally segregated city in some prominent respects, and I think this affected hospitals. Do you recall how black patients were treated?
Black patients were segregated. Practically no hospital in St. Louis had black patients other than Barnes Hospital. And those patients came through the clinic, which was a very large operation back then, still is, so that there were no black patients in any other hospital. I think, if I'm not mistaken, because I was involved in this, Jewish Hospital was the first private hospital to take in black patients and put some black physicians on the staff.
But Barnes Hospital treated them, as you say, because they came through the Washington University clinics. Right? And the clinics were housed now what they call the West Building, which is the pathology area. Can you describe that building as it used to be? It's been so vastly renovated that it has no...
Well, it was just a bunch of corridors on different floors with hardback seats back to back, and always full of people sitting there waiting to be called into his little side cubbyhole.
So virtually all your medical, all sorts of medical treatment was rendered in that building.
There was one clinic that had a special character. It was called the Night Clinic, and it was primarily a VD clinic where shots of 606 were given. And that was a pretty busy place. I don't know that VD has been separated as a clinic anymore.
Just talk about your experience at Jewish Hospital. First place, Jewish Hospital was already on the location that it is now, right?
Yes.
It was a King's Highway, but a much smaller building, and it was not yet a part of the Washington University
That's
Medical
right.
Center.
That's correct.
And then it was physically separated by the somewhat larger St. John's
yes.
Hospital. St. John's was, of course, fully operating in its old
setup here.
When do you recall when Jewish became a part of the medical center or began cooperating more closely?
I think that all started about 18 years ago. I'm not sure the dates. It's all a little vague to me now. But there was a long period of preliminary sparring and then final culmination of the arrangement that exists today.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think Jewish and not St. John's, which is after all was physically closer to, were there rivalries between the medical staffs that prevented
no,
that?
I think if we had to choose, find some criteria for why this took place between Jewish and Barnes rather than St. John's. First of all, St. John's never was a teaching hospital. It's not much of a teaching hospital today, although it does have some teaching facilities and some full-time men. Jewish Hospital post-war dedicated itself to more private, full-time teaching. It's always been a teaching hospital. Men who have been members of the faculty here at Washington University Medical School have taught there too. And so teaching has been a tradition. I think this separates the two hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
One was traditionally oriented to teaching, the other was not oriented to teaching.
I see.
And this, I think, was the reason for the thing. Post-war, there became this tremendous movement for full-time men. And in doing this, you had to tie into a medical school where you could have an executive faculty that could determine the choice of people that they wanted as well as that you wanted.
Mm.
And so I think that was really the beginning of this idea.
Uh-huh. But Jewish at that time was a general hospital. It
yes.
Had
correct. But always a teaching hospital.
Oh. We've talked about medical breakthroughs briefly in connection with the World War, but already by the late 30s there were significant changes in internal medicine being introduced, were there not? Can you think of anything? How about sulfa drugs?
Sulfa drugs was the only really big breakthrough in medicine. And the other breakthrough was partly accomplished right here, and that was the kind of surgery that Dr. Everett Graham introduced, in which you could open up and take a lung out and develop techniques for doing that, the
mm-hmm.
anesthesias and so forth.
And radiology, too.
And radiology, of course, with the gallbladder visualization in which Dr. Graham had a leading role. But aside from these few things, the big things happened post-war. For instance, post-war, a resident in surgery would consider one gastrectomy a year as disastrous training. He never got to do any. There was only one man who could do a gastrectomy in St. Louis pre-war, who was considered capable of doing. The early ambulation. And then, of course, all of the computerized techniques. These are all post-war. Blood transfusions really got their go in post-war, and I think I played a role in it. I get prepared for Dr. Graham while I was at Jewish Hospital. I prepared the first plasma that was used in this city, and he used it on a patient post-operatively. And I think I'm the first to have brought blood banks to this city in the 30s.
Again, this was at Jewish Hospital. Mm-hmm. How did you come upon that concept? Was it something that you had followed in the literature and as followed in other cities?
Well, before I left my medical school training, I developed a very deep interest in microscopy. And when I went to Jewish Hospital, I went to Dr. Sam Gray, who was head of the Department of Pathology, and told him my interest in blood cells and so forth and the microscope. And I spent almost as much time in my 3 years in training as a resident in internal medicine in a laboratory. At the same time, I got involved with Dr. Michael Somogyi, who was in the Department of Biochemistry here and was one of the early founders of the isolation of insulin. In fact, Washington University, I think, would have had the grant money for insulin if Dr. Schaefer hadn't stopped Dr. Somogyi from publishing his work.
And why did he do that?
Well, that was his opinion, and he was the department head, and he could stop such a publication. And 2 months later, Banning and Best published it in Canada. But Somogyi had worked out the technique, and actually the real technique is still his technique for preparing insulin. Well, I got to working with these two men as much in the laboratory as anywhere else, and in the course of this blood study, I encountered this idea of blood storage, and I was told that I was a crazy young man, you can't keep blood in bags. Well, time has proved how crazy I am.
Did it have any pre-war applications at all?
No, blood transfusion called for calling in some specialists like a Dr. Ivy here, and there he'd stick a needle in a vein and a bottle, sterilized bottle here, and a stream of blood would flow through the air into the model. You had to have a good catching hand with the bottle. That's the way transfusions were given.
Let's proceed on to your work at University of Minnesota. You were Dr. Downey was reconciled to your presence there. What was the experience like? First of all, this was this in Minneapolis?
In Minneapolis, 1935 to 36. Well, first of all, he turned out to be as gentle as he could be, and that gruffness was only on the surface. He was a fabulous teacher and a hard taskmaster. He made me really learn how to prepare tissue, how to stain tissue, and how to look through a microscope. And I had the good fortune of sitting at his elbow at least an hour every day while I was there. In addition to that, the University of Minnesota had a fabulous All-American football team, and so I got to see them play. Minnesota in the winter is gorgeous, but that was a horrid winter. At no time for 32 consecutive days did the temperature go above zero.
Oh my.
And when you walked across the campus there, the wind would howl at around 40 below zero. Also got to know Eugene Normandy, who was a symphony conductor there, through some people I met. So I visited with him, and that was a nice.
You were still interested in the fiddle, I take it. He himself was a violinist.
He was a violinist in a movie orchestra or something like that. He's gone a long way since. But that year turned out to be a marvelous social and medical year, and then on weekends I would go down to the Mayo Clinic and consort with their hematology people. And one of their men was working on lupus, and that was the first description of the LE cell. I followed that up in some work I did here.
Who is this person who is doing?
God, the name slips me. All I know is it begins with an H. He was one of the fellows at the clinic. I just don't recall. But you know, Dr. Albert Taussig here kept insisting way back that lupus was a generalized disease and not a skin disease. And he preached that all the time. And he was excited when I came back and showed him some of these LE cells in bone marrow.
Uh-huh. That's funny. Of course, when we're the good times at a good university notwithstanding, we were still talking about the Depression all throughout the 30s, really. And can you tell how that affected medical practice? I mean, and the economics of medicine?
The economics of medicine, I felt, was tied in with the rest of the economic situation. And so people lived at a lower level and enjoyed their lives just as much, I think, in some respects more than they do today with the affluence that they have. Good medical men were men of stature. I think, as a matter of fact, a medical man was considered at a higher level back then than he is now. And I think part of the difference is that there was this art of practicing and this art of living rather than the mechanistic money-making thing that people accuse us of today. I think it was a much more pleasant way of living than the practice of medicine today.
Well, you had to, though, at times show great forbearance if you were treating people who just didn't have any means to pay for.
It was very simple. You just forgot about it.
Uh-huh.
You treated them without pay. Clinics, of course, were much more active. But you see today what's happening with your clinic is with third-party payments, clinics are vying for business in a community where there isn't this low-level pay. They aren't. Well, let's take the setup here with faculty and so forth, furnishing faculty with complete medical care at low cost. They're furnishing unions special contracts.
Prepaid health plans.
Prepaid health plans. See, those weren't around back then.
You know, they're mighty handy arrangements, at least it's my own experience. You, who lived and practiced most of your life in the big cities, perhaps didn't meet, or did you meet doctors from a really early era who were still in practice, who didn't have a did you ever run into any contact with homeopaths or people who were from a very different kind of approach to medicine that whose might have now disappeared from the scene? Anything?
No, I think that I think there still exists this same sort of thing, just under a new coat, cultus, very questionable medical practices. I think it's no different now than it was then.
Except that, of course, when you had people who were, say, trained in the 1890s and were still practicing in the 30s, you at least had a rational explanation for the way they were. They were just trained in a different world.
That's very true, but then if you look at it from the patient's standpoint, the patient didn't know the difference. And these men developed techniques of satisfying patient needs. And then, of course, inherent in the practice of medicine is a matter of good luck. Nature takes care of an awfully lot of stuff that the doctor may think he does, but he doesn't really. So the odds favor the physician, whether well-trained or poorly trained. In the vast majority of medical problems.
Let's talk now about World War II. Why did you, how did you happen to get involved with General Hospital 21?
Well, during our medical school days, there was a section of military training, and I stayed with that program from 1932 on and went to summer camps and so forth. And this unit then was formed. I actually was assigned to the 36th Infantry down in southeast Missouri, but the man that had been chosen to be the lab director at the Washington University unit developed some pulmonary disease and was ineligible, and they had heard of my background and training in laboratories. So I was asked to join the unit as the chief of the laboratory service. It was a question of whether the head of the internal medicine department should be a classmate of mine or whether I should be. That was Sim Beam. And they figured that since I had all this lab background, they'd make me the lab officer and Sim Beam the chief of the medical service.
Who was making the decisions in this regard?
There was some committee here at the university, and the major power in that committee was who subsequently became our commanding officer, and that was
Dr. Cady?
Lee Cady.
Mm-hmm. What contact did you have with him before the
Practically none.
Activated.
About 6 months before I was called by the university, I don't exactly remember whom, and they asked if I'd be interested, and I said yes, and then they arranged my transfer to the unit from my original assignment. Mm-hmm. We never really met but once or twice subsequently.
Uh-huh.
And then we, that was about 6 months before. On the day before Christmas, we got our alert, and I had to keep my wife off the telephone because everybody was calling wanting to know when we're leaving.
Uh-huh.
I held off on her until Christmas Day Eve, Christmas night. That was Christmas Eve.
Uh-huh.
I just simply shut my drawers in the office. I had all the notices prepared to go out to patients, and uh-huh. we left on January the 10th.
Mm-hmm. So then you were among the original contingent that went down to Fort Benning.
Right, and
for
the 21st in the Cleveland unit were also among the first in World War I, so they both seemed to be eager beaver to get there first.
Uh-huh. Well, what was the training at Fort Benning like, and you were introduced, of course, to the real Army, I imagine, to some degree, and all the paperwork and orders and discipline to some degree. Did you make situations where practice situations that you might find in the combat zone?
Well, one of the in this introduction to the Army, I might say that the Army had more trouble with us than we had with them. We had a bunch of really fine medical men. These were like Henry Schwartz, this caliber of person. And so we had fine trained people, but they also happened to be characters. I
mm-hmm.
think they picked some of it up from their faculty here at Washington University.
Uh-huh.
And we had an offset. We had a whole hospital, whole station hospital operating and no medical personnel to run it. So they were glad to see us coming. We just took over the whole hospital, and the regular Army men who were around were primarily administrative. And we went our way and they went their way, and whenever there was a conflict, they usually lost.
Except there was friction between the commanding officer
this was a commanding officer who was regular Army. He had been trained for many years as an expert in the health service. He was one of the top ranking Army officials in the health service field.
Colonel Thomas?
Davis.
Davis.
We call him Stinky Davis.
Uh-huh.
Now this was a man who, despite all this training, had a Napoleonic complex that couldn't meet
uh-huh.
the situation. He was a nitpicker, and he was crazy.
Uh-huh.
He woke me up in England at 4 o'clock in the morning, cold as I could be, and said, "You are now the executive officer."
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's the sort of thing we ran into. Finally, he made a mistake in North Africa of locking horns with our chaplain. And told him that he spent more time with his army problems than with his religion, we'd all be better off. And of course the chaplain went right straight to headquarters, and that was the end of Colonel Davis. We had Colonel Thomas prior to Colonel Davis, and he was transferred, and then we got Lee Cady as a result of Davis's being sent home, and that was a tremendous break. Lee Cady had a fabulous way of making friends with the French, with the engineers, with everybody around us, and at the same time he did not follow the principle of hanging on to his all-stars, which is what other hospital units did, and they stagnated. We had tremendous numbers of promotions as a result of Lee Cady letting men go. I forget, I think we had ended up like something like 32 colonels at the end of the war who went to other units. And so we developed a reputation through him of being the friendly hospital. Engineers came to get baths. We had very interesting experiences when we got overseas. We happened to land in Oran and then go on to a little town called Muhanifia. This was an old second-class watering place. We cleaned the place up, we scoured it up, and I was walking in Mascara, a few kilometers from our hospital one day. This man walked up to me and he said, "You know who I am?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, I'm Chung Hao." He said, "You saw me every Saturday in the movies when you were a little boy." And it's the guy with the big glasses, you know, the Chinese character. And through him, I met the man who ran the CAV there, which was a government-owned thing. And Mascara is the largest area for producing table wine for France, was back then. Made his acquaintance. And a very lucky thing happened. The Americans were sending over canned milk for feeding infants, but they didn't know how to use it. And Spalding was our head nurse, and she
Lucia
had trained.
She
had trained with McKim Marriott, who had worked out all this formula business. So off she trotted with a bunch of cans of milk, and we were buying wine at 2 francs a liter. That was 4 cents a liter back then. And we had a beautiful roof on the top of our hotel, and name bands liked to come through because we had hot baths. So every Saturday night we had a dance. And we furnished the wine for the dance. And these guys got a hot bath and a clean bed overnight. And this is all part of the sort of thing that Lee let us do. And it made it a fun family. We worked like the devil. We were supposed to handle 1,000 patients, and at times we were handling 3,000, but nobody grumbled.
Was your lab right in the Grand Hotel?
Oh, yes. I had the old wine shop. It was my lab, and it was very unique, and we kept the big wine casks around, cleaned the place up, and set up a lab. In Italy, we went to the place that Mussolini had planned to have the 1940 Olympics outside of Naples, and there my lab was covered with magnificent murals made of ceramic tile.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of that too, but that was had been severely bomb damaged in that area.
Well, we got enough roof on us to handle it.
Back to Algeria, though, didn't you have some considerable sanitary problems when you first moved in?
Oh, yes. Question of getting the water supply straightened out. What we did was tap into some of these deep wells. The other sanitary problem we had was that the local physician would always say, "You have paludism. There's no malaria around here." We'd take him out a little dunk of water and show him the Anopheles mosquitoes. Then he'd say, "Ah, say La Seroca, the wind blows it in from the desert." But we had the sanitary problem with the health. They were almost 100% infested with worms, and 95% infested with malaria, and it meant special caution in treating them.
Well, these have been the native Arabs?
Native Arabs, and Of course, we used a lot of Arab help because we expanded so tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And this, again, was Lee Cady's idea. He didn't play it by the book. He played it by what we needed. He was a very practical sort of guy.
So you had to inoculate the...
Well, we had to treat their malaria and give them medication for their worms. Uh-huh. And also keep scrub brushes in the toilets so they'd scrub their hands when they came back to work. Teach them about such sanitation details.
Now, it wasn't just the big Grand Hotel where you operated. There were other hotels in town.
Little buildings all around the place. And we took over a whole city on the edge of the desert. Looked like something out of Lawrence of Arabia, you know.
It was probably not safe to go stray too far from the area.
There were no problems, really. The natives didn't cause any problems. I think one of the craziest things that happened was that the colonel sent a captain and me to a little town railroad junction with 45s, and we were supposed to protect the medical supplies of the 21st General Hospital with three Arabs who could have shot us dead any second. And that was quite a sight. I wish I had a picture of it. But there they had this fire built, no shoes, and they kept sticking their feet in the fire. Of course, their feet were like shoe leather. Here are two medical officers with two 45s in the middle of the desert, supposedly protecting supplies. But by the time we had arrived, all of the enemy was gone east.
Germans and Italians had been wiped out of that area, and also the Vichy French.
Vichy French weren't going to do anything. They were a little politically, they tried to be present obstacles, but we simply brushed them aside and went on with our business.
When you got to Italy, you were pretty close to the zone where there was still fighting going on.
Well, they were bombing Naples every night almost, and we were just on the outskirts of Naples. Right behind our bivouac, there was a battery of 90mm anti-aircraft guns, and they'd go off every night. I got to where I got tired of running to the caves, so I just slept through them.
Yeah, I think one can adjust to the most amazing...
Right. But the bombing was primarily for the harbor in Naples.
When the big invasions led to the fall of Rome took place, Anzio and other, you took a lot of casualties in it.
Tremendous numbers. And... again, we were an expanded hospital, but by use of civilian help and know-how, by that time, you see, we were the most know-how hospital in Europe. But we had been through a year of almost to the day in North Africa, learned the ropes. A cute thing happened in Italy. I set up the first blood bank there, and we advertised on a radio, we take natives. About 10 of them came, and after that they didn't want any part of it, and we were paying them to give blood. The other thing was that I set up a shot of whiskey for everybody that gave a blood transfusion. And I caught a hell from the base section surgeon who said, "What are you doing, running a blood bank or a bar over there?" But see, the young guys would come out and have their ticket, and then there'd be others waiting for them. Either donors or non-donors would buy the ticket to get a shot of whiskey. It was the best use of medical whiskey during World War II.
You also had a hot water spa in that vicinity of Naples, where you were billeted.
We were billeted in the Terme Agnano, which is a world famous watering source, and Agnano water would sell for around 90 cents a bottle here in the United States back then, so you see it was given quite a bit. And the Italians, well, so did the North Africans, because there was a spa there. We hooked showers into them. We had these crazy Americans letting this beautiful water just to take a shower.
But it was at least pure enough to drink.
Oh, yes. Naples had a very fine water supply, actually. most of their water came through old aqueducts going back to Roman days from the mountains. It was pure mountain water with no treatment in between.
I understand that Vesuvius went off when you were there.
We retreated to that. You could see it going for days. And we all went there, walked through the ashes, saw how they were buried back.
Yeah, were you concerned that the winds might shift and your
It was too far away to hit us. The big damage was done to one of the airfields where the commanding officer really got his tail wrapped. He let his plane stand there while burning up with this ash. Another interesting thing about Naples are this all started back in North Africa. Dr. Ferdinand Isseman, who was a rabbi here in St. Louis of Temple Israel, was a Red Cross worker in North Africa. And his main objective, he felt important to educate the young GI. And so he started a town hall of the air. And I ran into him in Algiers, and he was telling me about his experience, and he was very sad because the thing was so successful that one of the Army Special Service men wanted to take it over as his project. And I said, the important thing is run the project, forget about whose prerogative it is, let him have the credit if he wants it. He was very dismayed. I think he went home not too long after that, but I picked the idea up for our hospital. As a result of that, we had entertainment galore. And we had a beautiful theater in Naples. And the Barretts of Wimpole Street came with Catherine Carnell in the lead. And I'm trying to think of the male who was a very famous actor. They came to our hospital and spent 10 days, and it was a magnificent experience. And there's one part of the play where the mean father, who happens to be a very gentle Texan, throws the red-headed daughter on the ground because she announces she's going to marry this captain. And one of the kids in the audience yells out, "Kick him in the ass, Red, kick him in the ass." Others, she made rounds one day. I made rounds with her, and she went up to this young soldier, wounded soldier, and asked him if he liked theater, and he said, "Well, yes, ma'am." And she said, "Well, what kind of theater do you like?" And he said, "Well, I like burlicue. I go to it once a month. Do you do burlicue, ma'am?" Another time, we had a special officer we had picked up in North Africa who had been hit in the head, and that explained some of his behavior, but he had a knack for finding things all over the place. We were known as scavengers of the worst kind. He comes to me one day and he says, "Hey, Colonel, I got a fella, his name is Heifer or something like that. He plays a fiddle." And the guys over at the airport told me he's just arriving fresh from the United States. "What do you think?" I said, "Just bring him by." So I just finished dinner, and I was sitting in a lab, and in walks Yasha Heifetz with his accompanist. And we just sent word out that there was going to be entertainment tonight, and other hospitals were in the air, and they filled the theater. And he was shaking. Heifetz didn't know what the hell to do. I said, "Just be Heifetz. Just go out there and play." So he played, and they wouldn't let him get off the stage. They tore the handles off the seats and banged them just to keep them on. Finally, I waved to him and told him, "I think you had enough." But it was a great experience to have people like that come through.
Yeah, I think I've seen pictures of a banquet that you had him as guest.
It wasn't all a bad war, you can see, because in this Terme Agnano was a little walled garden, most gorgeous little thing you've seen, and off to one side was a special house, and Meyerling killed his new bride in that house.
Well, the house. It wasn't Meyerling was the place where they...
Yes.
But the Austrian prince.
Yes.
Rudolph or
somebody. Yeah. Anyhow, I gave the first dinner party there, and then the colonel took it over. But it was a gorgeous setting. So you see, it wasn't all bad.
Uh-huh.
And we also had a Olympic-sized swimming pool on the grounds. Uh-huh. And
that was in operation.
Yes, and since I was interested in health, they made me health officer, which gave me a set of keys to the thing, and I could use it anytime I wanted to.
Well,
and we were sitting
nice
there
indeed.
At the poolside one day, and had a 40-foot Olympic tower, and here's this guy going off, and Henry Schwartz puts his hands over his eyes and says, "My God, I just put a plate in his head 2 days ago."
did the diver survive?
Oh, yes.
Oh,
Henry almost didn't.
Well, when the time came when you had to move on to France, you didn't really know where you were going.
No.
They hadn't really even cleared the territory in Lorraine. There was a lot of trepidation about that.
Oh, we just went. We never thought, I don't think we ever thought very much of the dangers of war after a while.
Yeah.
For instance, if you stop to think about it, we were practically unescorted across the North Atlantic.
Uh-huh.
If they had sunk our ship, all of the medical personnel that we're talking about would have gone down.
Yeah.
So we weren't very trimmed.
Yeah.
The French experience was a very interesting one because we took over what had been planned as a neuropsychiatric center in...
Ravenel Hospital.
It was called Ravenel Hospital. And it was in the northwestern part of France, not too far from Nancy. And other than the usual things of getting... But by that time, we had developed a great deal of expertise, and we had developed good contacts with engineers. They're terribly important in setting up a hospital, getting electrical things going. We used cyclotherms to furnish the power for a good part of it. So we had extra power, and we picked these things up along the way. And these become, utilities become a tremendously important thing in a hospital, much more important than your instruments, your doctors, and so forth, because you can't work without them. And as I say, we developed a lot of these know-how things that make it easy. Well, there are a lot of things were unfinished in these buildings. They were gorgeous buildings spread out over a large area.
Mm.
And
we have pictures of them.
And
here,
they
here
lent
in the
themselves
archives.
Beautifully to operating a hospital.
Uh-huh. I showed you earlier a picture of the laboratory, and we have you squinting into the microscope, and then a table full of your colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
Lucille Spaulding is there. Let's see if we can get a hold of that picture. I think we have it someplace here. Okay, we're now making reference to official photographs that were part of the report, the narrative report, the General Hospital 21, and we have them in the General Hospital 21 collection, and then they were reprinted in the Washington University Medical Alumni Quarterly, and there's one particular picture of the laboratory, and we see Dr. Agris looking in the microscope, and we see a number of the other people. There was Abe Bolotin?
Yes, executive officer.
Uh-huh. And there's Lucille Spaulding in the picture. And there's, in the larger picture they clipped, I think there was even some POWs, some nurses that were I think they cropped the picture to exclude them, but you had quite an operation going.
Yes, we took some German personnel, and we had a German section to our hospital. There were German prisoners of war, and we used their personnel in the laboratory to help carry out some laboratory techniques. We found they were very poorly trained, they were not very knowledgeable, and we had to get rid of them because they were propagandizing the Nazi propaganda, especially a very gorgeous blonde who was about 18 years old and the daughter of the ambassador to Brazil. You just couldn't have them around.
Oh, that's interesting. You had them playing in an orchestra, though, I understand.
Yes.
Music
was in our soul around the hospital, always, and the little village where we were stationed is France's center of violin making.
Oh?
And
this is Mirecourt?
Mirecourt, and there are several luthiers there who have been there for a long, long time. They come from the families down in Italy who made the Strads and so forth from the village of Cremona. They came up to this area and they set up as luthiers. And it was a very interesting experience because they had real artists making these violins. They would have this man set up a violin on an easel about 20 feet away, walk back, take a dash, take a spot, put it on the violin, and wait 2 days for it to dry. And they made some good violins. They're known as that. And it was through that that my wife got to know where I was. I said, just ask my friends who play the violin about violins in France.
Uh-huh.
And it's a very famous uh-huh. violin center, and I took up the violin again.
That was a way to get around the civil censorship as to location, I take it.
Yes. Uh-huh. And we had all sorts of signals in that direction.
Uh-huh.
The censorship had much to be desired. It was amazing at some of the leaks that took place. Sam Harbison, who was one of our surgeons and a very good violinist, picked up the violin along with me, and we played there. One of the other musicians was John, our GU man. He was a piano player and a darn good one, and that would make for much gaiety, especially at the officers' club.
Uh-huh.
And don't forget, we were not too far from the famous wine country of Burgundy, so our officers' club was well stocked. And one of my missions once a month was to inspect the laboratories of the hospitals in the northeastern part of France. So I'd go down to Dijon, which was just outside of Neuilly-Saint-Charles, a very famous Burgundy country. And then I'd go over to a rest home in the Vosges Mountains that the 36th General Hospital ran. And from there we would cross over to Evian-les-Bains, which was an old watering place mm-hmm. like Atlantic City. And no troops there at all, American or what you call, but a can of coffee went a long way, a pound of butter went a long way, and so we had first-class hotel accommodations and fabulous food, mm-hmm. like fresh trout taken out of a trout run and mm-hmm. frog legs.
Uh-huh. Sounds
that was one of the jobs the colonel gave me.
most appealing. There were also some hunting expeditions, I'm told.
Oh, yes.
I didn't go on any of the boar hunts.
The big boar hunter was Joe Edwards. We called him Killer Edwards, because I think he caught two boar on one of these expeditions.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't figure out why they all didn't get killed going out the way they did, and the natives fanning the brush.
Uh-huh.
They came back alive. That was an interesting thing. Another one was a bombing Christmas Eve.
Right, this was
right at the hospital.
The Battle of the Bulge.
Yes.
Did you ever think that the Germans would overrun you any moment? Or
no, we didn't feel that way. We felt that the Seventh Army was invincible.
Uh-huh.
And although that's the nearest I ever came to any. This one fellow who dropped a bomb, scraped a hospital. I fell into a ditch. I could see his tracer bullets, and I would say I could feel the impact of the tracer bullets maybe 25 feet away.
Uh-huh.
That's the closest I ever came to anything.
Uh-huh. Well, then right after that, of course, you had a big flood of casualties from those
the Battle of the Bulge
in engagement. Well, it wasn't too long after that that Germany was defeated. Did you travel at all in occupied Germany before returning to?
I got up into Frankfurt and into Cologne and saw the devastation that was carried out. Some of the war is a funny thing. The accidents that happen are inexplicable. For instance, the cathedral at Cologne was partly pockmarked with shells, but this whole plaza around it was nothing but skeletons of buildings and a railroad station immediately behind it. And here was this beautiful cathedral, mm-hmm. well preserved.
Of course, the pilots were under orders not to hit the cathedral.
I know, but when you start burning out things like they did there, I don't see how they could do it.
What were the circumstances of your return? Did you stay with the 21st until the end?
No. As soon as the war in Europe was over, they wanted experienced medical officers to take command of units going to the Far East, to the Pacific, and I was one of those chosen. I was cleared out of out of the hospital overnight and back in the United States in 48 hours. It was a special deal. I really worked this over fast.
Can you tell me more about this assignment?
It was called a Green Project, and it was, as I say, primarily a medical officer replacement deal, primarily for command positions with station hospitals and lesser units in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So I came back to the United States, and I was assigned to Indianapolis, and then from there to North Carolina, and then the war was over.
Uh-huh. Did you really think that you might have to be sent into
I actually had all the protocol handed me for the command and
uh-huh.
so forth.
Uh-huh. So you were going to be on a hospital ship, maybe, that was in the fleet that was going to attack Japan? Is that how they...
No, probably set up station hospitals, which would be land-based
uh-huh.
Hospitals, smaller than a general hospital.
Uh-huh.
It could have been a general hospital, too.
Well, then, 1945, early 1946, you resumed civilian practice.
Mm-hmm.
And why did you choose to return to, so many others did, at this point, have a break in their career. Dr. Keady, for example, went into the VA. Did you have any temptation to...
No, I think I can understand Dr. Keady's doing it. He became very professional at this business of being a military physician, and he developed a tremendous know-how in the management of hospitals and so forth. So his interest was not the practice of medicine. His interest was primarily in the area of hospital management and so administration and so forth. My interest was going back into the practice of medicine.
Mm-hmm. So you returned to a Jewish hospital. Did your position, then you also resumed your position at Washington University on the clinical faculty. Well, tell me at this point, if I can jump ahead, because we have only a little bit of time remaining, your experience with this Midwestern Cytology Laboratory Incorporated.
When I was in North Africa, the first publication of the pap smear was made. I got interested, since I had been interested in the microscope. On my way home, I contacted Dr. Papanicolaou in New York and went out on my own. I had to teach myself because this was an early stage in the field. You couldn't give it away back then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then I was instrumental in getting some showings of the pap smear in movie theaters here in the St. Louis area through the American Cancer Society. And we took busloads of women to various theaters and showed them these movies of the pap smear. And that was really the beginning of an expansion of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Cytology Laboratory is a private medical service,
yes.
though, right? Where is it housed?
Well, I had an office set up where its work is carried out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where is it located?
8631 Delmar, right with my medical practice office.
I see.
It's diminished considerably from what it was. I was running a factory for a while, which I didn't want.
Uh-huh. At the height of its operation, how large a operation did you have?
Oh, tremendous operation. I had 11 in help just doing cytology.
Uh-huh.
And we were doing thousands of smears a month, now a few thousand a year.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
The pathologists have taken it over.
Well, lots of these do have independent laboratories doing their work. Perhaps maybe smaller cities that don't have the larger hospitals to do this.
Well, I ran into a practical problem. When the pathologists went into this and set up their private laboratories, they started cutting prices, mm-hmm. and I wasn't willing to do it.
Uh-huh.
I felt it couldn't be done at these low-level fees.
How did you come to be a consultant in pathology to a veterans hospital?
When I came back from the Army, they didn't have a hematologist, they didn't have a pathologist. They knew that I had done the work with the 21st General, so they asked me to take over, and we would get a new pathologist every month for a while, but it finally squared away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are you a believer in the system that the medical center has developed, whereby your certain area physicians become clinical faculty? Is this a kind of quality control?
It's a tradition I've been raised with, so I do believe in it,
mm-hmm.
And I do believe that along with it is a full time necessity for full time people. The problems that arise, not infrequently, more particularly in private hospitals than in a large hospital like this, a university hospital, is that there's poor correlation between the full-time and the part-time men. Part-time men are not utilized the way they used to be. That's a change. But we also raised a new era of prima donnas in the full-time faculty. These guys take a job one place and they're already looking for where they're going next at a bigger salary and a more prestigious.
Regretfully, our tape ran out just as Dr. Egress was completing his views on this important issue. This is the end of Oral History 54 with Dr. Harry Egress.